The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. It doesn't feel like a Thursday. I guess it was because we came back late from the weekend activities on Monday night. In any event, this week's almost over, and lots of big changes around here at Edstone. We're welcoming in some new students. We've seen some four-year graduates who come from this area return home here recently. And so it's an exciting time. There's quite a few more people around Edstone, and everyone, I think, is pumped up for a productive summer. I actually just wanted to bring that out here at the start, because coming up in the second segment, I've got a couple of really some fascinating stories. Well, I guess fascinating is not the best word. It makes me appreciate just how far advanced the education and the training is at Armstrong College. Of course, we've built the college program around the AC model, the AC being Ambassador College, the college that Herbert Armstrong started decades ago. And when you read or study anything about what Mr. Armstrong had to say about education, he is way ahead of his time. And as these pieces will bring out that I'll get into later, you see so much in the way of problems and difficulties for young people today. Last week we talked about the poor work ethic that they have, and then of course there's just the problem of higher education, which is in so many ways just indoctrination, and so it's setting our young people back. It used to be that, as Mr. Armstrong would explain many, many years ago, that while modern education might prepare them for making a living, it certainly doesn't teach them how to live. And yet today, I mean, you have to question whether or not the higher education is even helping them to make a living. They've given up on teaching them how to live. I mean, that fell by the wayside long ago. So as I say, stay with me and we'll get into more of that coming up in the second segment. But first, some of the headlines from over the past couple of days. Here in the UK, of course, it's voting day, and it's looking like the only question is how much of a majority Theresa May will end up with. But, you know, it's been over the last couple of years, we've seen some pretty shocking developments when people go to the polls. And so we'll have to wait and see when those final numbers come in this evening and tomorrow morning. In any event, I guess what's astounding to me is just that the other one, the one that she's running up against, Jeremy Corbyn, is just astounding to me that he's even at the position that he's in. Foreign Policy had a devastating piece about Corbyn today, saying that it's not just dumb to vote for him, it's really dangerous to vote for a man like this. It goes back and it chronicles the 35-year career of Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party leader, how that if you go back to 1984, this is within weeks of the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, setting off a bomb that nearly killed Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher at the time. And it was Jeremy Corbyn who invited Gerry Adams, the leader of the IRA's political wing. Corbyn invited Gerry Adams to Parliament for a reception within weeks of the bombing. This article explains how that he sat on the editorial board of this far-left magazine during that time. This is back in the 1980s. This magazine that praised the IRA and its violence. And he attended rallies honoring IRA terrorists. I mean, this has been his career. He makes no bones about it. I mean, some of the things he tries to justify, but basically, he makes no apology for the fact that he reaches out to terrorists and to terrorist organizations. He's called Hamas and Hezbollah friends. That's a direct quote. He considers them to be friends. Hamas and Hezbollah, not even Fatah, or not even the so-called more moderate organizations. These are the extreme terrorist organizations that want to wipe Israel off the map. He's appeared on Press TV a number of times. He's been paid to do it, in fact. This is the television station that's put out by the Iranian regime. Churns out propaganda for Iran after Osama bin Laden was killed. He said that was a tragedy, a great tragedy that Osama bin Laden had been killed. It says here in the article, Corbyn once invited to tea and praised as an honored citizen a Palestinian Islamist who claimed Jews were behind the 9/11 attacks. The Jews were behind 9/11. And he praised this so-called honored citizen, this Palestinian Islamist. Foreign policy says, the list of dubious relationships, crackpot proclamations, and leftist sympathies for some of the vilest governments and political movements on earth is endless. In a 2003 book, Corbyn insisted the Soviet Union was no real threat and that North Korea is not a rogue state. It says later, after Hugo Chavez died in 2013, Corbyn eulogized the Venezuelan strongman for, quote, showing that the poor matter and the wealth can be shared. Ridiculous. That country has been ruined. But he praised Hugo Chavez for showing that the poor matter. Foreign policy says further, though it is custom in parliamentary systems for a party leader to resign immediately after losing an election, Corbyn is not a customary political leader, but a blinkered revolutionary. Now that he and his hard left acolytes are firmly in control of the Labour Party. See, the hard left, it's firmly in control of Labour, just like the hard left is firmly in control of the Democrat Party in the United States. And so all of the news today, it's going to be about James Comey. I could not find one story on the Comey hearing today that I felt worth reading. It's just, you just want to tune it out. And yet that's all that you're going to hear in the United States today. They have restaurants that are playing it live. The Comey hearing today in Washington, D.C. It's crazy how obsessed that far-left media is. How obsessed they are with just trying to bring down a political opponent. That's all that it amounts to today. And here it talks about Jeremy Corbyn and how that it's customary for you to step down if your party loses. But not with this particular leader. These hard left acolytes, they are in firm control of the Labour Party. It says, indeed, one of the most alarming aspects of Corbyn's rise is the cast of fellow extremists he has brought with him, like Seamus Milne, the former editor at The Guardian, and bona fide Stalinist, or John McDonnell, the shadow chancellor of the Exchequer, who approvingly quoted Mao Zedong's Little Red Book during a House of Commons debate and once signed a letter calling for both MI5 and the country's armed police force to be disbanded. That's someone right there close to Jeremy Corbyn, someone who wants to have the MI5 and the country's armed police disbanded. I think there were a few police on Saturday night that wished they were carrying a firearm. Once that attack took place, you had some of the policemen that were right there on the scene that had to run, just like the pedestrians, just like the civilians, because they didn't have a weapon. And so it went on for 8 long minutes. These are the kinds of leaders in Israel today. Well, yesterday we talked about the mayor of London. And the problem the problem that Britain has with radical Islamism. Here are these three attackers. I mean, one of them was on a Channel 4 documentary supporting the Islamic State, praying. This was last year. It was on national TV, praying in front of a jihadist flag right there at Regent's Park in London. And just like Tim Stanley brought out at the Telegraph, I mean, how, after seeing this, how could law enforcement officials not immediately arrest these individuals? Instead, they're given space. They're given room to plan their operations, their terrorist operations. One of the other attackers, he was fighting for the so-called rebels in Libya, bringing down Gaddafi in 2011. Of course, you had the United States and Western powers supporting that. That's another tragedy in this story. In any event, I mean, here he is, fighting with hardline extremists, and then he just returns back to the UK. Well, he was denied asylum initially, but he used his EU residency card to get in through Ireland. The third one, he was apprehended in Italy, an airport. He was trying to get to Turkey and then on his way to Syria so that he could fight for ISIS, so that he could fight alongside his ISIS brothers. And the Italian authorities wouldn't let him take off. They interrogated him. He said proudly, "I'm going to be a terrorist. That's who I am. I'm a terrorist." Well, the Italian authorities gave him some space to operate. They did, however, track his movement to London. He moved to London. And according to the Italian authorities, they told British authorities about this dangerous individual. And, well, all three of them just living and operating there in the greater London area. And you heard yesterday the London mayor talk about, well, how can we follow 400 people? It's impossible. And of course, one of the big problems here is that, well, because of political correctness, you have to use all of the law enforcement officials. You have to use all of the resources that you have and spread them out evenly. You can't really zero in on just 400 because that would be Islamophobia. And so you see just how much worse this problem is going to get. Margaret Thatcher, she was quoted as saying, this was after the 9/11 attacks many years ago. She said, "We have harbored those who hated us, tolerated those who threatened us, and indulged those who weakened us." I mean, if that was true in 2001, what would she say today if she were still here? What would she be saying today about these 23,000 subjects of interest walking the streets of Britain? Apparently, there's 400 or so that have returned from the ISIS battlefields in Syria and Iraq. And you have the mayor of London saying, well, you know, I can't follow 400 people. But as outrageous as this is, whether you look at the mayor, whether you look at the far left in the Democrat Party, or whether you look at Jeremy Corbyn and his 35-year track record, as outrageous as all of this is, I mean, look at the effect it's had on all of our peoples, as so many of us have fallen into this same trap of thinking that, well, this is just the way it is. This is the new normal. People are going to be killed. It happens. As so many on the left are saying, look, you have people die in car accidents. You have people die of cancer. You have people die because of a botched robbery. And so you just have to kind of lump this in with all the rest. And a lot of people hear that and think, well, I guess, when you look at the numbers, I guess that's true. So we just keep calm and carry on. Michael Doherty at National Review says, stop comparing the London attacks to freak accidents. and natural disasters. This is different. This is totally different. He says, imagine if Saturday's three London bridge killers had been British Nationalist Party thugs ramming their car through a Pakistani neighborhood. Would a single decent person have heard the news and immediately said, well, this number of people or dead people is statistically insignificant compared to those that die in car accidents? These punks can't threaten our society. Would anyone have asked, why are we talking about the killers' politics? There are thousands of gun murders in America every year, and those killers don't have their politics talked about. We all know the answer, he writes, and yet, even before the victims on London Bridge had stopped bleeding, this was the reaction among society's best, brightest, and most morally self-assured members on social media. The pattern is now, it's by now familiar. Even as an Islamic terrorist killer's proclamations about Allah's will are still ringing in victims' ears, these individuals are already declaring that the true danger from the attack is on Islamophobic backlash, and that you're more likely to die by drowning in your own swimming pool than from a terrorist attack. Do they know how callous that sounds? This is Michael Dougherty at National Review. He concludes with this: do they not realize that sensible human beings react differently to a car accident than to a murder plot? Or that states and car manufacturers are constantly working to decrease the lethality of driving, while terrorists are constantly trying to improve the lethality of their enterprise? It's totally different. I mean, look at the intent, the motivation behind it. How can one compare what happened on Saturday night here in the London area to an accident, to a freak accident? The motivation there, as Melanie Phillips brought out in her piece this particular week, it's to kill us. They're at war with the West. They're at war with Britain. And they stated outright, just like one of the three attackers from last week, I am a terrorist. That's who I am. I'm going to be a terrorist. And another one, just as proud, on national television. Another piece here at Spectator. I don't think I need to go through any of it, but it just talks about the headline. It says that after five centuries, religious war has returned to Britain. I mean, we're entering into a dark age. It's happening now on London Bridge. The kinds of atrocities that you couldn't have imagined happening there, at least not over the past century or so. You have to go back 400, 500, 600 years when there were beheadings and the like. Well, this article talks about religion being the motivating factor here. Sometimes it can be hard to recognize ghosts for what they are. Reactions to the atrocities committed on Saturday, as to the atrocities committed only a few short weeks previously in Manchester and on Westminster Bridge, have mingled despair with perplexity. It says here, this is at the Spectator, we just don't understand violent religion. We just don't understand it. And yet if you look into the Bible, I mean, you know that another religious clash is coming. It's really already starting. PJ Media had a piece about ISIS and this publication that ISIS puts out, Rumaya Magazine. And they're basically saying, look, I mean, if we can adjust, and they've been doing it. Look at their recent track record. When things go bad in Iraq, I mean, they can move to Syria. If things go bad in Syria, they can move into the West. And they're doing it. And they're saying, look, Manchester was a tremendous success. We've killed the Crusaders. in Manchester. That's the way they see it. That's the way they're talking about it. They're writing about it. It's a religious war. It's a religious clash. As I say, this quotes from an Islamic, a radical Islamist publication, which says, just 1 week before the blessed month of Ramadan, the world's attention was focused on the British city of Manchester. A soldier of the Khalifa had carried out a just terror operation, striking Manchester Arena at the conclusion of a concert by an American singer. This is the foreword to the magazine. And it's distributed in several languages online. The explosion rocked the city. This is the way that the Islamists are reporting on it. It rocked the city and filled its residents with terror as many of them scrambled to try to contact their loved ones and ensure they were safe. Then the casualty figures started emerging. More than 20 had been killed and dozens more had been wounded. The total would later climb to nearly 100. It says, in the wake of the bombing, the panic-ridden friends and relatives took to social media to enlist the help of strangers in the search for their loved ones. Local pubs began offering free booze to emergency personnel in need of clearing their minds of the traumatic scenes they had witnessed. British Muslims came out. They have Muslims in quotes. Not real ones, in other words. They came out and offered their deployed on the streets. And offered their token denunciation, out of the fear of retaliation. It says further on, ISIS asserted that the Manchester attack, quote, seemed to confirm what so many analysts had been asserting for some time now, that with the loss of territory in Iraq and Sham, the Islamic State would shift its focus towards carrying out attacks on Crusader soil. Well, we'll see. We'll see how much they're able to carry out. But I mean, you know from Daniel 11:40 that it's going to push and push hard at Assyria, modern-day Germany. And you also know from other prophecies, like I mentioned yesterday, there in the book of Hosea, that strangers are going to devour the end-time nations of Israel. And that's what we're seeing that's beginning to happen. A religious war, a religious clash. That's what Daniel 11 and verse 40 is all about. As you're going to have the king of the north finally lash out at this radical Islamic movement and go right after the head of the snake, Iran. I mean, even Iran was hit yesterday, and there were quite a few on the far left in the media again that were rising to the defense of Iran because they're one of the good guys now. President Obama made peace with them. And President Trump, he's a hypocrite. He's making a huge mistake, they say, siding now with Saudi Arabia and standing in opposition to Iran. I mean, they can't see anything straight. They can't see facts as facts are happening. Everything. It's just like with Jeremy Corbyn. It's just like with the far left in America. The thinking is just totally upside down. And it's not to say that those on the more conservative wing or the far right would have the solutions either. But what a deadly disease this far-left thinking is, and it's spreading. It's spreading all across Britain and all across the United States. Well, there's a few other headlines here. I don't know if I'll take a lot of time with them, but one from the Telegraph talks about a German foreign minister who said that Donald Trump's Middle East policy is completely wrong. I mean, we know about the division between the United States and Europe, Germany in particular, over NATO. And President Trump's recent visit through the continent. But here is the German foreign minister speaking up now and saying, look, the Trumpification of the Middle East, it's a failure. It's a disaster. He came out and criticized the arms deal that President Trump made with Saudi Arabia, the Gulf monarchies. And now there's going to be a new arms race because of it. That's the German foreign minister here again. Sharp division between Germany and the United States. Shifting over to Southeast Asia, we had a piece at the Trumpet, I believe, yesterday, or maybe it was this morning, on this report coming from the Pentagon saying that Beijing is arming those man-made islands. Surprise, surprise. China's outfitting those man-made islands with warplane hangars, weapons, and so on. They're moving forward. Foreign Affairs had a piece the other day, too, about this new EU-China relationship. And we've talked before about the coming trade war and how the United States and Britain are going to be frozen out. And so you see headline after headline about China drawing closer to the EU. China's reaching out to those nations that the United States is alienating. Same thing with Britain. As Britain leaves the EU, China's stepping in to fill the void. And it's building to a trade war. There was another interesting piece as well that Richard forwarded to me yesterday about the world sitting on a $400 trillion financial time bomb. It's not just a problem with the United States. I mean, worldwide financial catastrophe is coming because of the debt levels, because of the promises that nations are making to those that will have retirement funds. It just says here at the last, the U.S. will find itself in the biggest hole, falling $137 trillion short of what's necessary to fund adequate retirements in 2050. I mean, 2050 used to seem like ages, ages ago or ages ahead. Now we're just 30 years from that, 30 years or so. $137 trillion short. Trillion with a T. That's what we're talking about now when we talk about the astronomical levels of debt. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. Well, we could go on, but we'll get into something a little more positive and hopeful in the next segment. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire, and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Last week on this program, I referred to Ben Sasse's latest book, The Vanishing American. He's been out trying to promote this work, and in it, he writes about a coming crisis. America's facing a coming crisis without parallel in our history. He said that we're living in a state of perpetual adolescence. Our young people never grow up. They don't know what it's like to be an adult. And he talks about how the older generation has forgotten how to teach and to prepare our youths for adulthood. And one of the big points that he makes in his book is just the declining work ethic among young people, how that young people will look for any and every possible way to get out of work, to take the easiest route possible. Herbert Armstrong, again, when you talk about what he taught regarding education and maturing and growing, and growing up to accept more responsibility, to accept the responsibilities of adulthood. He was way ahead of his time. This is something he wrote back in 1979. I mean, these kinds of instructions, they apply all the more so today. He said in the World Tomorrow booklet, the idea of happiness that has been generated in this world is laziness. Sitting around in idleness and ease and playing on a harp, perhaps, and having nothing to do but be waited on. He says later on, we're degenerating so fast that you just can't see it, and nobody will believe it because we like to kid ourselves and be deceived into thinking we're getting better and better. He said, you only get better and better when you work at it, and we don't like to work. We're allergic to it, he said. Now, that's something that he said, what, well over 35, 36, 37 years ago. We have to work at it. If you want to get better, if you want to improve, if you want to grow, you have to get to work. You have to really work at it. God the Father and Jesus Christ, I mean, they set this example for us. Jesus said that he works. He said that his Father works. They both are in this work together. And there was a sense of urgency in the work that Jesus did. He said, I must work the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes. I mean, I've got to finish. I've got to finish the job. God and Jesus Christ are workers. They have big plans for humanity. They have big plans for this universe. And right now they're building a family of workers, hard workers, people who love to work. God is reproducing himself, his character, his hard work ethic. But Satan is right now the god of this world. And he's the being behind this thinking that, well, happiness is somehow generated by laziness, by being able to sit around in idleness and ease. And of course, the Bible denounces that sort of thinking, and strongly so. We can't afford to be passive and lazy, certainly not in the times like we're living in now. We've got to get busy and get supportive of God and his work, our families, schoolwork, extracurricular activities, if we're in them, really pouring our heart into them. Another passage, let me just read a few verses from 2 Thessalonians 3. As I say, there's a lot in the Bible on this subject, and I'm going to tie it in here with education in just a second. But 2 Thessalonians 3 and verse 10 says, for even when we were with you, this we commanded you, that if any would not work, neither should he eat. I mean, if you're not going to work, you don't deserve to eat. You've got to get out there and provide for your own. Paul said in 1 Timothy that if a man doesn't work and provide for his own, he's worse than an infidel. Well, he goes on and says that there's some in the congregation there in Thessalonica that are busybodies. They're not working. Working not at all. That's what it says in 2 Thessalonians 3:11, verse 12 says, now them that are such we command and exhort by the Lord Jesus Christ, that with quietness they work and eat their own bread. You see, be quiet, quit being a busybody, Quit being just a talker and get busy and work. He says finally, but you, brethren, be not weary in well-doing. Don't faint. Faint not, as the margin says. This ties right in with the admonition to work and to work hard. Now, this article, this one I alluded to at the start, it's a Bloomberg piece asking why teenagers, American teenagers, aren't working anymore. It says for baby boomers and Generation X, the summer job was a rite of passage. Today's teenagers have other priorities. It goes on and gives some statistics saying that we're coming into the month of July here in a few weeks, that it used to be. I mean, that, well, it's not, it still, I guess, is the busiest work month for U.S. teens. They're out of school, they've got the summer job, and so the July statistics they're revealing. In July of last year, 43% of older teenagers were either working or looking for a job. And it says that's 10 points lower than it was just 10 years previous to that. And, of course, you can go back further than that to the 1980s, the late 1980s, when the teen participation rate in the labor force was at nearly 70%. I mean, today it's 43%. So it gives some reasonings for this decline. And some of it, may not seem like it's that big of a deal if they're putting more time into summer classes or spending more time at schools. But as we'll look at here in just a second, when you consider what they're getting at school or at particularly at college or at university, well, you can see where it's just an unproductive cycle. It's indoctrination in so many ways with the educational system. Says all this studying has obvious benefits, but a single-minded focus on education has disadvantages too. It's talking about those who forego work or practical hands-on experience so that they can put more time into education or the classroom. But the Wall Street Journal, this is Bloomberg, sorry, it says a summer job can help teenagers grow up as it expands their experience beyond school and home. Working teens learn how to manage money, deal with bosses, and get along with coworkers of all ages. And so it just talks about the practical lessons and how much is there for experience, or how much is to be said for experience. You need both, in other words. You need both. And as I said at the top of the show, that's why you see the program that Mr. Armstrong was inspired to set up in Ambassador College starting back in 1947. And he was writing about it. He was writing about it, I think, in January of 1947, before Ambassador College even opened its doors later that year. There's a fascinating article in the Old Plain Truth. Before the college even opened its doors, and you can see the whole vision of AC. It was spelled out in such beautiful detail. Mr. Armstrong had it all in his mind ahead of time. God inspired it. And here was a man with no experience in higher education. He didn't even go to college. And yet by the time his life had ended, I mean, he had raised up three colleges around the world, three colleges on two continents. And it had a perfect balance between classroom training and education, and on-the-job training and education. And, of course, there was much more as well when you bring in all the extracurricular activities, the social outings and occasions. But look at what young people have today, or look at what they don't have when they're finishing up high school and then contemplating what it is that they're going to do after that. There's another piece here. This is the Wall Street Journal one. Many colleges fail to improve critical thinking skills. I mean, this is disheartening, the message in this one. And it's, again, it's not like it comes as a shock, but it just shows how that young people aren't really being educated. They aren't learning to think for themselves. They aren't going into college and then 4 years later coming out a better person. And it goes through statistic after statistic. At more than half of schools, at least a third of seniors were unable to make a cohesive argument, assess the quality of evidence in a document, or interpret data in a table. That's what the Wall Street Journal found in studying some of these tests. It says, at some of the most prestigious flagship universities, test results indicate the average graduate shows little or no improvement in critical thinking over 4 years. I mean, that is sad and tragic, particularly when you consider just how much they're paying for that education. Little or no improvement in critical thinking over 4 years. 4 years. Well, if you read the opening pages of Mystery of the Ages, Mr. Armstrong, of course, finished that in 1985, but he was talking about some of his thoughts on education from as early as 1927. He refers to the first dummy copy of the Plain Truth magazine that he put together. This was, of course, many years before the magazine was actually published. And he had this artist draw a picture of a schoolroom, and then there were the students sitting at their desks. And each of them had this funnel stuck into their head. And the teacher was just pouring out this propaganda into each child's head. That's what it amounted to. That was in 1927 when he came up with that idea for a Plain Truth cover. That was 90 years ago. And there he was throughout his ministry talking about how education, certainly there's no instruction there about how to live. It's just all a matter of memorization. You just remember the facts that they give you in class. And of course, so many of those facts are coming from this far left, you know, hard liberal thinking, propaganda. And it's turning out leaders like what we have in London and the UK and the United States. We've followed on in the steps of Herbert Armstrong. My father had an article last year, February of 2016, The Deadly Path of Higher Education. I've written myself over the years about the paradox, of course, following on what Herbert Armstrong said in some of his powerful articles on education from the late 60s and early 1970s. But here you have all of this knowledge, all of this modern advancement, and is society improving? I mean, look at the article I paraphrased in the first segment. I mean, we've got beheadings and throats being slit on London Bridge, things that haven't happened in 500 years or so. Are we really getting better? Are we improving as a society? Does it make you feel better when the left wing comes out with, well, you know, it's just like any old natural disaster? Or it's just like an accident on the highway when a bomb blows up outside of an arena in Manchester. Does that really make you feel better about society? Does that make you feel safer? What is wrong? What is wrong with our society? And if you want to get to the answer of that, a lot of it gets back to education. Here, colleges today, they're filling our young people, their minds, with all kinds of knowledge. But is it helping them to build character? Is it teaching them how to live? Is it teaching them how to get along with fellow man? The more educated we become, the more we see our problems worsen. Herbert Armstrong was right on that. Right on that from the very beginning. He saw the direction. He saw where it was headed before the far left even came along. He saw the communist influence in education in the 1940s and 50s. And now look at all these Marxist professors that we have in the UK, in the United States. I think it's about time we get back to what Herbert Armstrong said about education, about work ethic, about how the two go hand in hand. And then you look at the model. You look at the educational model at Ambassador College, and how it continues today at Armstrong College. Of course, it takes a willing mind It takes young people willing to come in here and as I say to them so often, submit to the program. That's not easy, even in a wonderful environment like Edstone or Edmond. It still takes a mature-minded individual, a mature-minded 18 or 19-year-old, to come in and to embrace it, to go with it, to submit to the program, to use the information that they're receiving here, to apply it in their lives. Robert Morley, he had a piece back in 2012. And again, this you can see where the work ethic ties right into that valuable college experience. He said a couple of generations ago, if a high school student wanted to go to college, he first had to plan, work, scrimp, and save up the money. Sometimes he had to work for a few years after high school graduation before he could save up enough to attend college. Having to pay for college resulted in students who really valued the college experience. See, but this is a thing of the past. And now, I mean, they don't have to really work for it to get there. But yet, so many thousands and thousands of students go because of this. They can go into debt. They can get a government, some kind of a government handout to get them partway through. But think about what they're receiving. Robert Morley said, "This system has produced a generation of students taking degree programs that are essentially worthless. Some students at Harvard spend $62,000 per year working toward degrees in folklore and mythology." That's just in 1 year. You multiply that by four. Is it worth it? A four-year cost of $248,000. This is an article, by the way, from 2012. And the cost for higher education, it raises each year. Higher than inflation. But what are you left with? To use his example, if you spend $248,000 for 4 years on a degree in something like folklore or mythology, what kind of job prospects do you have at the end of that? Zero, he said. Zero. And what are the prospects of you being deeply in debt? The Wall Street Journal here says some of the biggest gains occur. Okay, so it talks about the problems in education, and it says then later on in the piece, some of the biggest gains occur at smaller colleges where students are less accomplished at arrival but soak up a rigorous interdisciplinary curriculum. Now, you think about what we have at Armstrong College, a smaller college for sure. But where students can come in and really soak up a rigorous interdisciplinary curriculum. They come here, students at Armstrong College. The cost is about $6,000 per year, maybe $7,000. And they enroll with $4,000 up front, and that offsets a lot of the cost for freshman year. And thereafter, then they go on to pay their own room and board, they pay for their supplies, their tuition, and they do this through the 20 hours per week student work program. And they're paid every couple of weeks, and half of their student salary is withheld to pay down those bills. The idea being so that they can get through 4 years of this and have all of their college debt completely paid off. They don't have $248,000. That they have to then pay down. But it's more than just paying off college fees. I mean, the student work program gives them the valuable on-the-job training, the hands-on training that they need, combined with the instruction that they receive in the classroom. And then all the lessons associated with actual work, work ethic, being dependable, learning to be efficient, to be creative or resourceful. Robert Morley said in that same article, "Armstrong College offers much more than job training for our students. Here, students learn about the real purpose for human life. They learn true values. They learn true values. That's the biggest blessing of all in an AC education, learning the true values, learning how to live." Mr. Armstrong summed it up best. when he said that true education is not of the intellect alone, but of the whole personality, not alone of technologies, sciences, and arts, but an understanding of the purpose of life, a knowledge of the spiritual laws which govern our lives, our God relationship, and human relationships, not a memorizing of knowledge alone, but a thorough training in self-discipline, self-expression, cultural and character development. Not book learning only, but broadening travel and experience, not only hearing and learning, but doing. Doing. See, it's all of it. It's the work together. The work together with the education, the classroom training. That's the AC model. And, of course, even before the students arrive, parents have, you know, their responsibilities to prepare their children for this tremendous opportunity. And on the actual work, you know, experience side, at least with me personally, I know it's been something that I feel like has been sacrificed to some extent just because of the prod that we've put upon our children to develop their talents in music and dancing and, of course, to be good students and so on. And they do lack some of the practical hands-on training that you could get from a summer job. Every summer, let's say, I put in a lot of time on summer jobs in my youth. But one thing that I know as I prepare my children for Armstrong College, I know how important the work-study program is at Armstrong College. And I know how much they're going to be pushed and prodded in working, in taking what they receive in the classroom and using it on the job. They may be a little bit behind, but hopefully the other benefits to developing their musical abilities and things, hopefully that will help them in the college experience and beyond college as well. Every parent, I mean, every family is a little bit different. But if we get this balance right, or at least strive for it, to get that right balance between the classroom education and the practical hands-on training, that's what God's system of education is going to be all about in the wonderful world tomorrow. What was established in 1947 by Herbert Armstrong, that little tiny campus in Pasadena, California, and just four students came that first year, and Mr. Armstrong had this grand vision of education in God's society, in the world tomorrow. How will it be like in the wonderful world tomorrow after Jesus returns to this earth and establishes God's kingdom on earth? It's not going to be these big sprawling campuses that bring in 30 or 40,000 people and then run them up debts that amount to $500,000 or $250,000. It's going to be very different. And families, parents, they're going to play a critical role in even preparing their youths, their young people, their children for the classroom. It's a challenge in this age. We're living in the very last years of Satan's rule, of Satan's reign over this earth. It is a challenge. When you look at what colleges today, universities are offering, when you look at the indoctrination camps that those campuses are, when you look at the kinds of things that go on campuses today, and you compare it to those 18-year-olds that were on those landing craft, moving across the English Channel, landing on Omaha Beach, Utah Beach, Gold, Sword, Juno, and storming those beaches, as so many of them were being mowed down. Those were some mature-minded young men. Some of them never had the chance to go to college. Maybe some of them wanted to. And then when you think about the young people today, on campuses today, the things that they complain about, the things that they protest, all of that will soon change. And you get a glimpse of the world tomorrow when you look into the programs that God is offering to our young people in His church. Salvation, I mean, stepping away even from the colleges and the academy, salvation is education. That's the whole point of God's plan. He's going to re-educate the whole world He's going to teach them the true values, what really is important. I mean, as far as critical thinking goes, what good is the education if you can't come out of college and know what's important and what isn't? How many people waste their lives studying into things or looking into things or following things that don't matter, that aren't important, or that are really low on the priority list? If you can't think critically coming out of that education, how are you going to be able to go forward in life and really putting the top priorities first? God, your relationship with God, your prayer, your Bible study, your worship of our Creator, and then taking the principles of hard work, the principles of true education into the workplace or into your living room. As you train and teach your young people, there's another, I see the clock, I don't have much time left, but there's another article here, a great one from 1976 by Herbert Armstrong. And he's setting it up by saying, hey, we ran this 20 years ago. So that would have been what, 1956? And it's about education. It's about the education with vision. And he says this is just as important today as it was in 1956. And I would add that it's just important today as it was in 1976. Well, maybe I can get into that a little bit more tomorrow. But that's all that we have time for on today's program. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.